AM 너는 빼지 않지 같이 함께 천국 같이 맨 정신은 반지
우린 좀 피해 후회 따위 내일에 조금 위험해
Hey man you better slow it down
다시 돌아오지 않을 오늘을 위해 저 하늘을 향해 건배해
This is Westminster Waves.
Online, DAB and smart speaker.
The sound of student life in London.
Hello everyone and welcome to the next episode of The Lectern, the show where ideas meet experience, research meets reality and the voices behind our university community take center stage right here at Westminster Waves. I am Mohammed Ashraf Sheikh, aka Ash, currently pursuing my master's degree here at the university and I'm thrilled to be your host on this exciting journey. Each episode, we'll sit down with MSc students, PhD researchers and members of staff to uncover the stories behind their work, explore groundbreaking research, discuss academic challenges and achievements and discover what inspires them both inside and outside the classroom. Whether you are a student, researcher, educator, or simply curious about the people shaping our university, The Lectern is your front row seat to insightful conversations and fresh perspective. So grab a coffee, settle in, and join us as we shine a spotlight on the minds, ideas, and experiences that make our university community extraordinary. This is The Lectern, and the conversation starts now. So today, we have a very wonderful guest with us, Mr. Timo, in the Westminster Wave studio. Something about Timo. So Timo is a member of PhD Society and also a student of PhD Society within PhD student within the University of Westminster. And also he's serving as a vice president of Westminster PhD Society. So Timo, happy to have you here. Can you introduce yourself? Where are you from? And tell us what are you currently studying?
Yes, of course. Thank you for having me. So where I'm from, good question to start with. Within the university, I'm from the business school. Myself, however, I am a European construct. So born in Germany and then raised and lived and studied in Scandinavia, but also in various parts of Germany. So consider myself more European German than anything else. And I'm now in London since the pandemic 2020. So almost 6 years now. And what I study is I am researching more the ideas behind how middle managers are making decisions within the digital transformation. It's a very digitalized society, environment, a lot of competition going on. And we know that there's one product outperforming the other almost every single day. But my research focuses more on how we are actually coming to make the decisions of the product we can see as kind of like the users. So, and that's what I'm interested in, more into the how and what influences decisions at various stakeholders or with various stakeholders.
Right. So is it more about like getting to know a product very firmly at different stages?
It's more about how we get to the end product.
Right. Okay, and what brought you to this university?
Why I choose Westminster is quite good. So I used to be at another university before, and I loved being there. However, I'm also having the mindset that you shouldn't do your master's at the same university where you do your undergraduate. Of course, there are exceptions, absolutely. But for myself, I thought, no, I need something different. I got to know the other university very, very well. And now it's time for something new to widen my horizon and not necessarily start from scratch, but see how a different organization, institution in higher education is working and functioning. And then, of course, the learning is different. And so I came, looked around. I had some criterias, and Westminster was was very much fitting all of my criterias. Mm-hmm. And I had a fantastic time while I did my postgraduate over here. Got to know amazing people, amazing members of the academic staff, which I now call colleagues. And through that, I had a lot of members of the academic staff who were then saying, you know what, why are you considering doing a PhD? And then I was like, maybe yes, maybe no. And then I looked into it, enjoyed it, and I had the immense privilege that my MBA project supervisor was offering to be my PhD supervisor as well. And that's how I got to stay with Westminster and my journey here.
Right. Okay. So, pursuing a PhD has always been your plan, or is it like is it not a part of your plan? But do you think like when you started to pursue the PhD, it sort of changed your the way forward, that like you wanted to pursue something else and you wanted to become something else, but then now you're a different person?
Yes, absolutely. So I have never been academically strong.
Right.
So I was very struggling, and my parents will definitely attest to that with all the support they were able to or had to push me through within secondary school. So I was just about making my German higher education leaving examination, which is kind of like A-levels,
right.
GCSEs in this country's and I just was about past that. I always knew I wanted to study, but I also grew up in a very liberal household, very free household, where we were not made to have to study. So we always knew there were other options as well. But I initially wanted to become a diplomat. So that was when I was in Copenhagen in Denmark, and I was very ingrained in the German society and culture groups in there, a bit too much now in retrospect perspective. But through that, I really like the diplomatic lifestyle, and you know, being kind of like there to represent the country. There are good mm-hmm. ways to go about this. A diplomat service or a diplomatic service is not just one way. There are so many different factors to it. And then I realized, no, I should study, because that way I have more chances to become in role of leadership and management, which were always the roles I was more drawn to. And that's how I then started studying. And luckily, a course which was called International Business in Asia. Mm-hmm. Was the right fit for me, so I thought. And you had to learn Chinese or Mandarin right. with it as well. That was not the best idea I had. I was able to get through with it, still have an interest in China and Chinese. So with that, I was able to then finally get into university. But it wasn't really my golden spot, I would say.
Right.
And then, however, I made an exchange semester to the University of Nottingham at their Ningbo China campus. Right. And that's where I fell in love with the British education system. The seminars, the lectures, how they were working hand in hand together. And that was exactly the way I was learning. And suddenly, you know, all the puzzle pieces which were floating around, they were kind of like gone and forming this wonderful picture. Didn't end up with a degree, but that opened the doors to get here. And after that, I like, no, I'm just going to do my bachelor's and then I'm going to get a job.
Right.
Then, as we know, pandemic changed the way we all were looking at jobs. And then I thought, okay, might as well do an MBA afterwards. That's how I got to Westminster. And that was basically the tipping point for better, because that's when I really started to enjoy academia.
Right.
but I still had my goal in making myself independent as a consultant. And through my time at Westminster, I was actually building it up, got my website and everything up running, got my first clients in as well. And then I realized it's so nice to actually combine the practical element with the theoretical. And that's where I thought, you know what, that's what I should pursue for the time being, and what I still do with my PhD now as well.
Right. That's good to know, actually, Timo, that you have a very different and very unique understanding about like how things should go hand in hand, you know, when it comes to creativity, when it comes to, you know, sort of designing frameworks or, you know, doing some sort of creativity, you know, updates or something like that. You know, I can see that you also were have been member of British German Association. So could you give us some idea on that? What exactly is that association does, and why do you think like there is a need of strengthening UK-German relations is like important or critical?
First of all, why I joined was quite simple. After 5 years in this country, I realized, I should maybe go explore again the back to the roots and see the thriving German community here as well. And then I think my LinkedIn algorithm must have figured it out, because I got to see one post after the other by the BGA, so the British German Association. And then I was like, you know what, let's just go to a meetup. Went there, loved it, and got to know amazing people. And then on my way back home, I subscribed and became a member. And since then, we have done so many beautiful events. So what the BGA does in a nutshell is they are more focusing on British-German cultural exchange and also German language teaching as a secondary language in this country. Unfortunately, secondary language teaching is on the decline. We can see that with French, with Spanish, but we see it mostly with German. Mm-hmm. Yet Germany and Britain have a very, very long standing relationship, have had its ups and downs throughout, you know, the decades as well. Mm-hmm. But in the 17th century, there was kind of like the first wave of Germans coming over, and one of them being very, very popularly George the First. So the royal family has been very, very Germanic for a very long time, actually until nearly the end of the First World War, when they then changed the name to what it is today, the House of Windsor. It used to be German as well, and everyone was married to German princesses or princes.
Right.
So, and we are building basically up on the merchant and the commerce part, bringing together people who have an interest in the culture amongst both sides. And we are celebrating as the BGA next year's 75th anniversary. Mm-hmm. So there are many exciting events being planned right now, and hopefully be able to get involved in a couple as well.
Right.
But what I'm basically doing there now is we just couple months ago introduced a youth committee. So where we really look into the younger members, and with that it's U30, so under 30 members of age, and to realize, okay, what is it? How can we make the association not necessarily younger, but how are we able to engage early on? Because it's the young people who are the future of any friendship groups as well. And last year, we then were also signing the Kensington Treaty, which is actively encouraging transnational exchange and partnerships and community building. So we are now fitting into, which is the first ever friendship agreement between the UK and Germany.
Right.
And you would imagine that we would have something like this in place for a very, very long time, but no. And this is how we are basically able to act together and Brexit, yes, hasn't been nice, hasn't been easy on both sides, whatever your stance is on it. But we are really trying to figure out now, okay, if you're not able to do it on a multilateral basis, can we at least do it on a dual lateral basis? Can we really foster some community? Sometimes just, you know, being aware, listening, not necessarily too much educating, because, but the education aspect is definitely the common pillar. Everything is in common.
Right. So you mentioned about like taking 30 students, you know, for this task. Or so is that like a selection criteria? How do you like select these 30 people?
Okay, so not 30 people. So it's under 30 years old.
Okay.
And I'm just a convener for the London area. So right. We have our head office,
mm-hmm.
And we basically operated on a expression of interest, and everyone who voiced an interest had to give a little statement. And it's my belief and knowledge, I could be wrong, so if there's any update, I will let you know after the show. But we were reaching out to everyone who had voiced an interest, because every voice matters. And then we try to figure out a day where the majority of people were able to meet. We know you will never get everyone to show up due to different commitments, diary conflicts. But we got a very good first meeting. We're going to have now for the London group. So we have a national group,
mm-hmm.
Which basically is for London, or which is England, London, and Scotland. We have now our Scottish group, and we have our London group, because London is very centralized, very centric, and this is where we have the majority of people interested. So I'm the convener here. My role is basically to encourage discussion and then filter through, okay, what's being said, and then deliver up to the head office as well.
Gotcha. Okay, so you have been also serving as a fellow for Royal Society of Arts, Manufacturers and Commerce. Could you elaborate, like, what exactly is that? And you have been also serving for RSA. So are both of them are like the same society? And if they are, like, what is being an RSA fellow mean to you personally?
Yes, so RSA fellow, it's quite recent. As well. And why I became a fellow there is it's more through an application process. And it actually came with the Kensington Treaty. So the BGA link is directly feeding into the RSA as well. But also with being, you know, self-employed, is fitting right in with the professional service side I do there. And so what it personally means to me is just a platform of very, very diverse people, very distinguished as well. Not just one industry, it's the entire bandwidth, and it's UK-wide. That's what I enjoyed. Fantastic events. Fantastic rooms as well, the RSA house, which is just near the Adams house as well, so just near Charing Cross station, and really good. So discussion, insights being shared in a informal but confidential environment, so no names being plastered around, but you're able to make connections. Those connections, yes, sometimes don't go anywhere. And other times, you know, you're just having good conversations, getting industry links, political links as well. So it's a mass of really interesting people with ideas and listening. So it's like, oh, interesting idea. You know, it's not like, oh, this is stupid, but it's more about, okay, can you tell me more about your narrative? Why do you want to do this? And then you're getting to talk with each other. And then you finally realize, oh, yeah, of course, here and there. Yeah, okay, that's where we maybe can do something. And that's what the RSA is. It's connecting minds. And that's also one of their slogans. And I can encourage to anyone who is interested, and I have to say particularly various PhD researchers or doctoral researchers here should definitely try to apply there, because it is just a different type of networking, and it's there for the long term.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, is it just yourself who's serving for RSA, or is it someone else, like, do you think, in our PhD?
I honestly don't know whether there's anyone else within our doctoral researcher group which mm-hmm. might be a member. I would be surprised if I would be the only one.
Right.
So that for sure. So we must have others as well. But that's also the beauty. The RSA events are mostly online. But there is also every day there's an event happening. So you can also pick and choose which one you want to attend. So I wouldn't be surprised if someone else is part of there.
Yeah, well, to my listeners here on the podcast, if you are a fellow of PhD and if you're doing your research, definitely do check it out about RSA Society. And I would encourage you, if you are studying in Westminster, University of Westminster, you should be able to, you know, get something out of this society as well. I can say, like, Timo, that you also have served as a fellow of Advanced HE. And I think Advanced HE is more like a UK organization that is responsible to promote, I think, UK higher education and higher education society. So what exactly do you look for? Like, what qualities do you think, like, higher education should focus on developing in students, and how you are contributing to that?
Yes, so I was just accepted as a fellow of the Advanced HE. So that was after I finished my postgraduate certificate in higher education. Mm-hmm. So, and that is, I think, just 2 weeks old now. So very recent. But one of the aspects of being a fellow in Advanced HE is connected, of course, with my teaching side here at the business school, particularly in strategic management courses and modules. Amongst them, of course, BABM, so Business of Arts, Business Management, which is one of our largest business courses. And then, of course, the MBA, so which is on postgraduate level. For me, teaching definitely is something which needs to be evolving with time. We always have different obstacles. We need to be aware of how we can give a skeleton, how we can give guidelines, how to deal with the emergent challenges, knowing that we will not have the answer to all of them. We are, and I think this is more like university in itself, we are very good in dissecting what has happened.
Mm-hmm.
We are not necessarily that good to create new ideas within the business environment. And that's not a criticism as such. It's more, we are better in researching to understand
mm-hmm.
what my research is about as well.
Yep.
But we also have we are lacking a little bit the daring move. Okay, let's try something and then we see what's happening. And that's what our students, however, are very, very good at. They are more like, okay, I will try this. If it doesn't work out, I'll try something else. And I think it comes with a lot of policies, a lot of unwritten policies as well, which every organization is prone to. We are, however, I think, quite good here at Westminster to listen, to understand what is happening, sharing ideas, what we have, but then sharing ideas and then actually acting on those ideas, there's a vast difference. And there, of course, we are bound by resources, and the most restricting resources we are not having is time.
Right.
So, and that is why I would say we do lack a little bit more the daring aspect, because we don't have the time and energy. But we do have the intellectual resources. We have our amazing students. We now have the Zone 29, which are fantastic spaces
oh, definitely.
For co-creation. for our students, and I do hope that we are able to work together, getting kind of like still the academic aspect in, the theoretical aspect, understanding what things are happening, what things are not happening, and why, how we can improve them. Mm-hmm. And I think this is where we are really able to thrive, because our student cohort is very diverse, very international from their background. So, and very first time academics as well. So who are the first in their generation, or first in their family. So first generation academics, I think it's right, the official term. And, you know, bringing them all together, that's what I'm thriving for, trying to get the ideas in and seeing what made them actually apply for business management. Right. It's a vast field. If you're thinking, oh, I do business management and then later on I'm going to work for Goldman Sachs. Yeah, possible, definitely able to. But, you know, there's much more to it.
Right.
If you, a lot of our students are coming from family businesses as well, and they are just having 2-3 employees, if at all. Most of the employees are actually family members.
Yes.
So, and, you know, there's a very good insight, because they don't function like the big organizations. I mean, you can definitely name some of them. And it doesn't work. And we need to be able to understand, okay, what is the purpose? What are you here? What are you trying to get? And we get an insight there within their motivational letters they are sending us when they're applying. Mm-hmm. So it's linking this together, building on it. It will change as well, yes, because if you're coming here, let's say, for the foundation years, right, which is level 3, you will have a different understanding, a different form of expectation than when you're going into your final year in level 6.
Right.
So, and it's more about, okay, where are you? What did you want to do? What has changed? Not necessarily why it has changed, but more, okay, what do you want to do now? And what can we do with our massive resources available to give you the package you require? So it's a bit more of personalization within boundaries.
Right.
But we also need to go away from, I would say, I don't use textbooks at all anymore, because there's no point, for at least I don't see a point anymore in textbooks.
Mm-hmm.
In other disciplines, you will need them.
Right.
But I don't think that necessarily in ours you need it. We are using case studies as well. And I through observations do see that even the case studies are now not the best engaging factors. And that's where we have to innovate teaching. We don't have to reinvent the wheel, but we do have to listen more. And with that, we need to be able to cater and make some changes within the curriculum quite easily. Absolutely. In order to address it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, coming back to your role as a vice president for PhD Society, I think I have asked a similar question to Wei when she was here on the podcast. Do you think, like, have you sort of brought any changes in terms of how PhD Society works or collaborate in University of Westminster based on your role?
So when Wei and I started our PhD, there was a PhD society.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, there was a lot of knowledge around, but it wasn't really anywhere. So we had a little bit of an issue in terms of figuring out, okay, what is it actually the society is doing, what it is supposed to do. And there was also more like the aspect of accountability. And with that, what we had to go through a reevaluation process. We had to get reaffiliated with the Students' Union as well. And that just took time. So if there's one thing I think we were able to do, which had our election, we have the new committee team coming into office now on the 1st of August.
Right.
So only my last couple of days in this role. And I'm very happy that we had interested people who wanted to take over the role. So, and this is what we have been working on. So, you know, Bushra, Wei and myself, we have been there quite from the beginning. Then you have been coming in after our previous committee member decided that he needs to spend more time for himself. And that's it. I mean, you know, that's what societies are. It should not take over your life.
Definitely.
Because your first responsibility is towards your research.
Right.
Or your progression. And it's noble that people want to get involved very early on, but it's rather to say, okay, are you really able to spend 1 or 2 hours a week in this role? And I think we got to that point that we were able to say, yes, it's possible. And we do have our new committee members, and they are going to do great work. And they're going to pick up basically where we have been able to get to. I mean, monthly coffee meetups with more or less good turnout. We had joint events with the Global Engagement and EDI team, which went very good. We have done the Dover trip as well. So, you know, and we wouldn't been able to do all of this if we wouldn't have had the support of our amazing graduate school. So, and they have been very big in supporting, but not just the graduate school, but also, you know, the vice chancellor's office.
Yep.
So they have also been very encouraging in order to get certain ideas implemented. And here I think I do have to say that Andrew Lin, or Professor Dr. Andrew Lin, who is the vice chancellor for research and knowledge exchange, who is on top of the graduate school, working with the graduate school as well. And he has been very steadfast. And I think this is where we got, okay, we feel supported, we are supported, and there is a willingness to at least discuss, because there were definitely topics which were not easy to discuss, but which had to be addressed with no outcome so far. But, you know, at least there are ideas going around as well, and we are able to work on these when the time comes. We also have an amazing PhD cohort. Very many are engaged in their way, how they want to be engaged. It's, you know, it's a voluntary commitment.
Mm-hmm.
To be part of it. You don't have to come. It's great that people are coming. Our friends are there supporting each other. And this is what we are doing. We are not here to push each other. We are there to bring people together. And I'm very happy that we were able to achieve that.
Yeah, I think to some extent, yes, we were actually. And when I joined this committee, you know, I was very excited because, you know, it was the first, you know, I've served many roles actually in this university. But to me, this role, it was a little bit of challenging role as well, I would say, because, you know, I was not part of this PhD society, like as a student of PhD. But however, you know, bringing that impact, you know, is something which my focus was. And when I joined and when I met you, we personally, I thought like, okay, there are some chances, you know, that there will be a huge impact that we can create, you know. And I think by time I realized that, yes, it is possible. And, you know, we were able to make it. So I think whatever we have done till date, I think it was fantastic. All right, so it's time for some fun and reality of questions of PhD life. So my first question to you, are you ready? All right, be honest. What percentage of a PhD is actual research, and what percentage is staring at a screen and wondering why nothing works?
Good question. I would say at this moment there is 0% research going on. That's simply because my data collection is about to start in September, and my probands, which are middle managers across different fields, are on holiday or preparing for holiday.
Right.
So, and yeah, so that's at the moment it's 0%. Staring at the computer screen and not knowing why it's not working, I think I will be able to tell you that more from January on, when I hopefully have enough data where this is coming. However, I would say in the last 2 years, I was doing extensive literature review, and the research bit was actually quite fun, and I really enjoyed it. The writing as well, annoying to rewrite. I hate rewriting sentences. I can't be bothered. Editing is the worst. But it's more about when you suddenly have an idea of how things could be connected, but you don't really make sense of it just then.
Mm-hmm.
But you have this thing that must be connected somehow, and then you start looking. And I think this is the most exciting bit. You don't know what's coming. And sometimes it's very plain and obvious, and other times it's not.
Right. Right. So what's the most PhD student thing you have ever done? I know you have served like a lot of roles, though, but again, like that is more like responsibility or responsible thing, you know. But apart from that, what is the most PhD student thing you think you have done?
I would say that is teaching while you're doing your research.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been quite lucky that I was able to do teaching quite early on. And honestly, I love it. Maybe a bit too much. So I think that would be the most PhD thing I've done. I've never done really... another thing is my brain works very weirdly at times when I can't really write anything and I'm staring at the screen, and no matter how much I'm doing writing exercises, it just doesn't flow. And then suddenly, oh, I have one idea for a sentence, and it's, 12 o'clock in the midnight.
Mm-hmm.
And then I turn on my computer, I start typing that one sentence, and suddenly the next time I'm looking at the clock, it's about 5 a.m. So that has happened quite often. And then I'm just, you know, writing in this process. And most of it is actually quite good,
right?
The writing. So, I think that would be more it.
Yeah, and have you ever like spent weeks solving a problem just to discover the solution, which was embarrassingly simple?
Not too much, but I mean, it goes back to the literature bit I said before. That was definitely something, because once you made the connections, it's like, it's so easy. And then you research, use all the different platforms we have access to. You always start with Google Scholar and put in the keywords. Oh, is there anything about this one? And you suddenly realize, oh, zero results. It's like, hello, what's here? And so I think that's more like where you get like this rush of endorphins. You're like, yes, something. So that is more about, okay, where do I publish it so that no one else is taking the credit for my weird 2 a.m. finding.
Yes. And how do you, like, explain your research to your family and friends without putting them to sleep?
It's actually a very good source of getting my family to sleep. So, not that I need much of it, but the tricky bit is, because my family is German, I do most of my thinking and working in English. And then suddenly you have to explain it in a different language. And I like to think that I'm quite averse in both German and English and some Danish as well. But suddenly if I need to talk about my research in my mother tongue, it's like, I can't find the words. What's happening? I do this because of that, and you know, And then you use the English word. What is that word now in German? So it's not necessarily the way I'm talking about my research. It's more the how can I talk about my research? Because in that moment, you just feel a bit stupid.
Yeah.
But the good thing is that, you know, I don't have to talk too much about my research. Yes, I mean, whenever there's something new, we tell each other and writing it, so they are informed. If they fall asleep while reading a text, I think that would be new. But otherwise, it's more the meta subjects we are touching on. So not the micro topics. We are more looking, okay, is everything going well? Are you healthy? Are you getting enough rest? Have you eaten? You know, all the... Yes, okay, good that you did an all-nighter again, but can you maybe try to get some sleep too? So it's more this form of encouragement rather than actual talking about it. But I also think because we are all quite tired when we meet up, mm-hmm. and... Yes, when you're spending longer time together, which are Christmas and New Year's. But sometimes, you know, you're on the break. You really need to shut down to a certain degree. And so we're not talking too much about it, informing, yes. And everyone gets their spotlight.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think it's more like encouraging. And then if there's an issue, however... Then it's more about, because both my parents work very differently, think very differently as well. And with this, it's a great source of seeing the problem from other perspectives.
Yes.
From other narratives as well. And then you bring that back after the holidays.
Right.
Did I put you to sleep now?
Oh, no, definitely no. Definitely no. I mean, you were like very much direct in what you were saying, and I think when we meet up friends, I think most of them are, especially like they are from different backgrounds, so they are not really interested in knowing what you are doing, or sometimes it's not like they are being tired or something, you know, because of work or whatever reasons, you know, and they don't show much interest. So to be honest, like if I do the same conversation with my friends, they will hate me.
No, I don't think it would be a hate, but it's... We all deal with our different universe.
Yeah,
because that's the part, you know, with postgraduate and PhD as well. It's a very specific and narrow context you are trying to uncover.
Yes.
Because that's what it is. It's novel knowledge you are creating. And it's very, very narrow. And I think with this, is you know all of it. But other, not really, because they haven't done all the reading you have been doing. They haven't emerged themselves into the level. And that's why you are the expert in goose science or whatever it's called. Yes, it's good. It's part of it. You're going to be an expert in that very particular field, maybe for a week, maybe for a year. Who knows? And then someone else is going to go even deeper. And that's the beauty with research, with academia. You're building kind of like this massive tunnel and go into the core and trying to uncover more layers and more layers.
Yes.
And no one is daring enough to go all the way to the hot centerpiece because you just don't know what happens.
Yeah.
And sometimes you need to double check again. I mean, I really like the analogy with when the Eurotunnel was built,
mm-hmm.
because they didn't just dig. They really looked into, okay, how is the stone like? And there was so much research going in into the processes. Okay, how can we make them more compact so that we don't have a problem later when we do actually the tunneling and then water breaks through everywhere.
Mm.
And these are all the distinct knowledge bits which are forming together. And I think this is so beautiful within research because we are all, yes, piecing our own picture together, But together, we are getting a much deeper, a much broader picture as well, and helping each other understand, advance, maybe even saying, you know what, why are we still doing X, Y, and Z? The entire society has changed, but in that aspect, we haven't changed. So why is that? And then once you realize it, okay, might be processes, then we go. But you can't uncover something if you're not looking into it. And sometimes, you know, you take a different route or you make a wrong turn, what you consider to be a wrong turn. And that's exactly the wrong turn you had to take, because there you finally see, oh, this is where we should go.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean that all the work you've done before is wrong. Right. It's not. But it helped you to figure out the way.
Right. No, absolutely. Very true, you know. Do you think, like, have you ever, like, searched or... Like, what was the weirdest question your research has forced you to ask?
Can you repeat that, please?
What's the weirdest question your research has forced you to ask?
The weirdest question... I would say my research so far, the weirdest, in your terms, question would very likely have been, why research in middle management decision making are not addressing the vast amounts of decision making tools which are available.
Mm-hmm.
They have been done by colleagues. They have been done by extended colleagues, or those who are researchers as well, in other PhDs. So why have they not been used? They are fantastic tools, yes, all with the limitations. But why is it that we need to answer the same question over and over? When I read the papers as well, which came out a couple of weeks ago, it asks the same question as a paper I've read from 2 years ago.
Hmm.
And there is nothing new, but the narrative is different. So, and I think that is the weirdest question I have asked. But that is a completely different research project as well, which I am interested in pursuing after I've done this one now, because it would be just good to understand, why are those different tools which have been made specifically for my target group not been implemented?
Right. Right. Okay, so I think let's talk about something more about future trends and research landscape. And probably when I say latest trends... I really mean AI. So, do you think AI is changing research in your field?
Oh, it already has.
Right.
So, but that's the thing with AI, in particular generative AI. It has been so disruptive and very quickly disruptive in the way we are thinking and the way we are teaching, the way we are researching. So it's across all the scope. It's very easy to get sidetracked with generative AI, particularly those who are using large language modules or models, not modules. And for better or for worse, I mean, we are seeing this hype at the moment, but the main area of concern, I think, is that we do not have any guidance in terms of what is ethically and morally accepted mm-hmm. to use generative AI for. I know we are currently working on principles here for the entire university, which are fantastic. So watch your spaces, because it's been brilliant conversations we have had around it. At the same time, I'm a bit conflicted, because generative AI tools, yes, they make certain aspects easier, more time effective and efficient. And I think this is something to look into. then of course we have to question, okay, how much can we do within our research? How much can we rely on these tools in order to outsource internally mundane work?
Mm-hmm.
But this is not new conversations.
Yeah.
We have had them when, you know, the printing press came in.
Yeah.
There were discussion as well. No, you know, students should still, or doctoral researchers should still write in Latin on paper.
Right.
And then later on, oh, actually, it has more advantages to use than the printing press. You can publish it much more. Then later on, of course, printing. And then, of course, the computers came in. But there has always been conversation about, okay, how much can we change in order to maintain the values of it? And we are just in this very point. We don't know what's happening.
Yeah.
AI tools are increasingly getting better, but they are only getting better with the data and the, you know, the information they're being fed with.
Yeah, absolutely. But do you think like AI will eventually complete parts of PhD research better than humans?
Maybe there would be, I mean, now we're very utopianistic, right?
Yeah.
And I'm like to see more the benefits of it. So maybe in a way AI tools and generative AI tools could be used to highlight certain weaknesses in your argumentation so that you're able to make your arguments stronger and that you're able to identify weaknesses within your own research earlier on.
Mm-hmm.
But that's also the point because, you know, particularly with a PhD as well, it's new knowledge you're creating. Yes, it's not that new as well. And with that new, I just mean it's not necessarily, you know, come up with a very new stone.
Yeah.
But it's the context which matters.
Yes.
And what we can see now that AI is, of course, very good in hallucinating.
Mm-hmm.
And this hallucinating aspect is the brainstorming aspect of any start of a PhD.
Right.
Whether you are applying for a PhD project or you're bringing your own PhD project in. So, and I think that could be an area of concern. But it can also be an area where you can actually create much more knowledge. I don't think there's anything going against AI because, let's be honest, it's competition as well outside. And it's the way how you use it.
True.
And if you're using it, I mean, we all know. I mean, English, yes, I love it. I write quite a lot in English, but my spelling at times is not the best. And then, I use spell checkers, right? But at the same time, spell checkers increasingly use AI.
Yeah, true.
And there's a question, how much is hidden and how much is obvious? If you, of course, write a paragraph, right, and then you use Copilot, what we have access to, and you say, oh, please rephrase this paragraph because to make it more rational. It will do it, and it does a very, very good job.
Yep.
But that is then the question, and that's what needs to be answered, or at least needs to be hinted at within the principles currently in development and then the policies derived thereout of, is very much, how are we able to distinguish between your own input with the assistance of AI to form a coherent thought?
True.
And that's where we don't have an answer. And we have, how many people are we here at Westminster? I think we're about 16,000 now. So, and we have 16,000 different ideas about this.
Mm.
And this is what we are having. If you're looking outside in the entire UK, the population, we have over 62 million people.
Yeah.
You will have 62 million different ideas of how to use AI or how not to use AI.
Yeah.
So, and this is where we are. I mean, Europe currently does an AI law or a regulation So they're very much, look, it should be used for the advantage. It should not be used for attacking. So a little bit like dynamite.
Mm-hmm.
So the principles, again, of it should be used for advancement. But we also know AI tools are being used in the weapons industry too.
100%, yes.
So, and there's the question, okay, but if we're using it in a certain context, how much should we be then doing?
Yeah.
And that is directly related to research, because our students are being bombarded with news. We are all being bombarded with news. And yeah, the hot topic, AI here, AI there. We can see what's happening with this country when it comes to projections. We can see the fake images going around, increasingly going around, not just by, you know, national press, but by international press as well, who then later on have to apologize for having used it. So, And there's like, how much can we sacrifice speed with accuracy?
Yeah, very true. Do you think like such kind of discrepancies exist in the university as well? And if so, are universities adapting quickly enough to technological change, like especially University of Westminster?
No. But that is mainly, and it's not just Westminster's, every larger organization. Mm-hmm. You will always have, you need to be careful. And that is the organizational setback.
Yeah.
And then, oh, we need to know more. That's why we came back for my point from earlier. We need to be more daring, and we need to increasingly become daring within a defined set of rules and values. Because that is how we are able to be participating within our environment. So I would say, yes, we have to become more daring, but it's not the fault of the institution. It's more like the structures within, and that's everywhere. It's in culture as well. It's in our DNA as well.
Yeah, true. True. So since we are running short of time, Timo, like, could you recommend something to people, you know, who wanted to pursue studies in PhD or who wanted to be a part of research, what and how they should plan their pathway?
Yeah, very simple. You don't have to know the answer just yet, but you need to understand within your field what is being discussed and what your PhD or your research is contributing to. It doesn't have to be reinventing the wheel. It can be just improving or seeking better understanding. At the same time, don't hold yourself back, but be aware this is a long-term adjustment. There will be a lot of changes. There will be a lot of hurdles going along, not so much obstacles, but you will need to navigate through with different questions emerging, popping up. You need to read, reread, read again. So, and if you're not able to make this kind of commitment, I would say, wait.
Right. And any of the skills that people should be aware or should learn before they start to pursue their PhD?
No, I think, if you're able to communicate your thoughts, if you're able to talk with people, that is definitely helpful. But that's also where we are coming in as a society, where we are coming in as a community. We are here to help you give a safe environment to bring up those skills. Our graduate school is giving you a lot of skill development as well. You do not need to have the entire handbook from day one. You will get there. That's the thing. PhD rarely is just about your research. It's also about your self-fulfillment.
Right. And one last question. So which category or which sort of... Because when you do PhD, you have like a lot of topics, right? So what do you think like is the most preferred topic a person should invest their time in for research?
It depends on you. Right. It really depends on you, because you're the one who has to work with it for 3, 4, 5 years.
Right.
So you need to be burning for that topic. You need to be able to, after those 5 years, not just, you know, oh, I've done my PhD, no, I can't look at it. You need to be engaged. You need to thrive for it. You need to enjoy it. It doesn't matter what the rest thinks. You need to enjoy it.
Right. So I'm sure, like, the thoughts that you have shared to our listeners here on the podcast, I'm sure, like, they might have...
If there are any novel the game.
I'm sure, like, they have gained some experience and you know, gained some of your insights, you know, because since you are doing your PhD and you are serving a lot of different roles, I'm sure people will learn from, gain some experience and you know, gain some of your insights, you know, because since you are doing your PhD and you are serving a lot of different roles, I'm sure people will learn PhD topics and some other roles that you're serving and how and giving some sort of encouragement to people who want to actually pursue their PhD. Thank you very much. A huge thank you to our guests for sharing their experience, insights, and journey with us. It's conversation like this that reminds of all the incredible talent, research, and dedication that exist within our university community. Thank you to all our listeners for tuning in and being part of this conversation today. I hope you have learned something new, found inspiration, or gained a fresh perspective. I am Mohammad Ashraf Sheikh, and you have been listening to The Lectern. Join us next time as we continue exploring the stories, ideas, and people shaping our university and beyond. Until then, stay curious, keep learning, and keep asking questions. Take care and goodbye.
Some planning and preparation went into her murder. The 78-year-old was found dead at her home on Dark.
This is Westminster Waves.
Stop calling but now, 'cause every time they do, I'm still crying over you. 'Cause even my mother, she still asks about you, about when you're coming home, and I keep telling her you won't. 'Cause what goes up must come down. I messed up, can't sleep now. If that's love, count me out. I remember the first time you called me, the first time you kissed me, the first time you said you miss me, and I said I missed you too. I remember the first time that we fought, the first time we made up, that first house we ever moved into. There's a first time for everything, but these will be the last tears I cry for you. These will be the last tears I cry for you.
Speak of the devil, why you calling me now? Too little and too late. I was sad, now I feel great. 'Cause what went up came back down. You're messed up, I see that now. If that's love, count me out. 'Cause I remember.